Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Well, we're getting to the last section of tonight's show. A few months ago, a book came out called Great Lost Albums. And reading from the back, thrilling, legendary, made up, it says here. The albums include Bob Dylan's imaginary collaboration with Liberace, Joy Division's musical theatre period, The Who's magisterial abandoned rock opera Bingo Wizard, and Kraftwerk's hastily deleted Christmas album, and many, many more. Actually, also noticed written on the back, it says, a shocking treasure trove of hidden gems. It gets funnier and funnier. Mark Ellen. So I must have read it before it came out. But I'm going to bring up and let them explain this complicated and fantastically funny book. Two of the most successful and revered crime writers in this country, Mark Billingham and Martin Waits. This is like the Graham Norton show now, is it? You have to... I'm going to get on Taylor Swift and John Cleese in a minute. Let's start the show! This is Mark Billingham on the left here, and this is Martin on the right. Fantastic. So could one of you explain, I mean, firstly, how this came about? Four of you, there are two other authors.
Yeah. Yes.
And if I remember rightly, you told me that you'd had an idea and that, I don't know how that idea came about, you can explain that, but you were then sent off to a pub or a hotel for an entire weekend and filled to the brim with booze by a potential publisher.
That's
and
pretty much
keep
it.
Keep going! Come on.
Yeah, well, yeah. Martin and I had done a gig somewhere up north and we're on a long train journey back and it may even have been the Beatles, Mark. It may even have been the Beatles. What would a great lost Beatles album be like? What would an album the Beatles never made or made and never got released for some reason? And we started just trying to be funny about it and made each other laugh for about 2.5 hours and got off this train and went, there's a book in this.
Can I say, we tried to make each other laugh.
Yeah.
We did have an awfully large space around us on the train.
Yeah, that was a bit
by the time we actually got back to London. I think it was actually Morrissey, wasn't it?
It was when
Morrissey's autobiography had just been released and we'd just bought it. And we'd started off just quoting bits to each other on the train in as fey and Mancunian a voice as we could manage, which then led us to kind of, what would the great Morrissey lost reggae album sound like?
And oddly, the great lost Morrissey reggae album was one that didn't make it for legal reasons.
Legal reasons, yeah.
Because one of the other authors of the book is Dave Quantick, who has been sued by Morrissey.
Oh, my God,
at least twice, I think.
We know that.
So we'll pass over that story.
Yeah.
Well, the great lost Morrissey album, Raga Polari, the great lost Morrissey reggae album, was actually in the delivered manuscript, and they went, the legal people at the publisher just went, no.
So, but you propose a number of combinations.
He's in there.
They're kidding our Costello theme.
Best backing singers he ever had.
I don't know why I look so miserable. I've never been happier in my life. Look, I'm with Elvis.
You got
I took that photograph, didn't I?
You did.
You took that picture.
In the bowels of Abbey Road.
Viewers, can you spot the person in the picture who's given up drink?
Yes. Clutching his bottle of water.
Yeah.
So that was a great moment for you.
It was a huge moment. But I mean, so it was this idea of trying to come up with... So basically, we came up with this idea on this train and we went, who else can write it? So Dave Quantick, who we knew, A as a ex-music journalist and B as an incredibly funny writer. So we'll get him on board.
And he's cheap.
So, yeah, and another ex-music journalist and crime writer called Stav Shires. And so the four of us got together and the publisher sent us away, as you said, to this hotel
like
in Hastings.
Python going off to write.
Yeah,
you know,
it essentially
Life of
was. We got sent away for a long boozy weekend where we had to come up with 50
albums, yeah.
And then we divided them up between ourselves and went away and sort of
now you propose various partnerships.
Yeah. The Dylan Liberace album.
Yes.
Las Vegas Skyline. I've missed this one. Tell us about this.
Well, this is Las Vegas Skyline, which is... Because some of the albums we'd known about for years, because there were rumours on the internet, that kind of thing. Some came to us as a complete surprise. But Las Vegas Skyline was one we'd known about. And Dylan had gone to see Presley. He'd gone to see Elvis in Vegas and had got the dates wrong. Elvis wasn't actually there that weekend, so he ended up going to see Liberace. Liberace, his mum, Dylan's mum, was a big fan of Liberace. So they got talking, and the next thing you know, that a studio is booked, and Dylan turns up, and Liberace turns up, and everybody thinks it's going to be, a travesty, and this wonderful album merges. This wonderful album, some great tracks on it. Tangled Up in a Blue Velveteen Jumpsuit is one of them. The Mighty Queen. There's all sorts of great, great tracks on this. I mean, they never mentioned it again. It was never referred to again. Liberace took to wearing a little sort of leather cap, like Dylan, a little rhinestone-covered...
Rhinestone-covered cap.
It's a great album.
Bob Dylan's next record is a Frank Sinatra's cover record.
Well, he'd work with everybody, so why not work with Liberace? It worked really well.
One of my favourites. Explain this.
Well, this is David Icke and Tina Turner, which...
The record that it should have happened. Why didn't it happen?
Well, it did happen.
The album happened.
Basically, Tina Turner's manager is sitting around one night. Tina had fallen on sort of hard times. She'd been very big for a while, and then suddenly, she's where's she going to go? She's lost direction. He sees this Terry Wogan interview with this guy and goes, she needs to team up with somebody controversial. At the same time, David Icke needs to spread his very vital message about the Godhead and a reptilian conspiracy. And he thinks the way to reach the kids is through music. So basically, David Icke and Tina Turner get put together, and they make this album Conspiracy of Love, which has some amazing stuff on it. I mean, it's quite clear that Tina is a bit lost, and she thinks she's making some kind of soundtrack to a lost Mad Max movie. She doesn't quite know what's happening, but she makes this album. The reason these albums never get released, legal reasons, artistic reasons. Yeah. This one never got released because David Icke and Tina Turner could never quite figure out a name for their act. I don't quite know why, but they never came up with a name for the collaboration and never got released.
I mean, there's a few that we came across that were like that. I mean, MC Hammer and Jimmy Nail.
Yeah, they couldn't figure it out. What are we going to call ourselves?
Absolutely.
What are we going to call ourselves? Never knew. What else you got on there? Freddie.
Yeah. Real picture.
That hair is just not real, is it? This is one of our favourites.
It was real when he bought it, wasn't it? I think it's...
This was one of the favourite. This is a cracker, because basically Queen had blown everybody away at Live Aid. They'd been massive at Live Aid, but had slightly lost their way in terms of reaching real people on record. And Freddie was looking for a new direction, and it occurred by way of a bizarre accident. At one of Freddie Mercury's birthday party, he tripped over one of his cocaine dwarves. He had these dwarves with cocaine on, and he tripped over one of them while reaching
for
Jaffa Cake.
No legal problem with this, of course.
Apparently.
With the departed.
Oh, I forgot this was being recorded.
The dwarves are dead.
Allegedly, there were these cocaine dwarves, and he was reaching for Jaffa Cake, and he tripped over one of the dwarves and got poked in the eye. Now, it's a matter of some debate as to what poked him in the eye.
It is, yes, yeah.
Brian May insists it was a very big sausage on a stick, but something poked Freddie in the eye, and he lost eyesight in one eye briefly, and he had this kind of revelation about using kind of optical problems, glaucoma, blindness, whatever it was, as a kind of way to reach people. And they made this album, which was going to complete the trilogy of a Night at the Opera, Day at the Races, An Afternoon at the Opticians. And they made this great album. It was fraught with problems from day one, because Freddie insisted that in order to really experience problems with eyesight, the band had to record with bags over their heads. So not just the band, the producers. Roy Thomas Baker's got a bag over his head. The engineer's got a bag over his head. So when you listen to it, it's you hear Freddie falling into Roger's drum kit. You hear Roger going, "Mind where you're fucking going, Freddie." There's also, but some of the tracks, Blurred Vision is a cracker. Yeah. I See a Little Silhouetto. I See a Massive Silhouetto. The worst track on the album, Brian's kind of 14-minute prog odyssey, Cataracts on the Window of My Soul, is a little bit of a bummer. But again, to hear that album is a great thing. So
that's the Lost Queen album.
That's the Lost Queen album.
Oh, crap.
The
Kraftwerk Christmas album, Transpolar Express. Because it came about. I mean, it's quite simple when you think about it. That Kraftwerk and Santa have a lot in common. They both have. They both see things as commodities and production lines. You know, they see themselves as we are the elves, as one of the tracks has it. And there's also the haunting 14-minute one. I wish to return this item. So it's not just looking at Christmas. It's looking at the aftermath of Christmas as well. And it throws quite an illuminating light on them, you know, which is something which, you know, they never actually repeat it again. I think that...
They played it to Eno.
They played it to Eno
and to Bowie.
And Bowie, yeah.
And they both loved it. They loved it. So Kraftwerk immediately boiled the tapes up for soup.
Yeah.
And so the album was never released.
Yeah.
But it's one of the best Christmas albums.
Just stew.
You can forget Motown Christmas album. This is the Christmas album you want.
That's the one to get.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Ah.
Hanoi Vera.
Basically, Vera had you know, she grew tired of Women's Institute lunches and that kind of thing, and she longed to be, this is in the late 60s, she longed to be the Force's sweetheart again. So she hit upon this idea of going out to Vietnam to entertain American GIs, and for a while it worked, and she made a great album to go with it. She brought in Mr. Rakabilk, Mr. Max Bygraves. You know, on some of the tracks, It's Very Unlikely We'll Meet Again was one of the ones. There'll be M16s Over the White Cliffs of Dover, that kind of thing. There were some great albums on there. Full Knitted Jacket, that was one of them. But she went out there, and unfortunately,
I love the smell of Earl Grey in the morning.
Yeah, that was a nice one. Yeah. She went out to the latrines one afternoon and was basically taken by the VC. And she disappeared, and then rumours started to circulate about this very feared VC enforcer. In black pajamas and a kind of bamboo hat, who would interrogate captured American GIs while listening to The Archers
and
making jam and this kind of stuff. And I mean, she went rogue. She basically went rogue, and you know, was you know, in deep country for a long time. And they sent various showbiz figures out. They sent Harry Secombe out. To try and bring her back.
That's not going to help.
He went upriver to try and coax her back. You know, and it failed, you know. I mean, in fact, there was a documentary made later because Francis Ford Coppola did make a film of it.
Sweethearts of Darkness.
Sweethearts of Darkness, yes. And, you know, you can actually, if you actually see that documentary of it, you know, you see Dennis Hopper.
Yeah.
Talking on the documentary, saying, they said Secombe, man. They said fucking Secombe. Yeah. And, you know, they send Harry Secombe up there. But as he said, you know, he confronted her. She blew a raspberry at him and told him to fuck off. So, rumour has it. They did try Catherine Jenkins after that, though, rumour has it.
Oh, look at him.
Oh, yes.
That's a gorgeous
picture. Look at him. The uncle of Funkel.
Yes.
There he is. The Godfather of Soul. Basically, this is an album called Angel's Delight, which was basically, mid-80s, late 80s, 88. He just released Living in America. The follow-up, Still Living in America, hadn't done very well. James couldn't get arrested, except in the literal sense of literally being arrested.
Yeah.
Which he was by the Aiken County Police Department in South Carolina, who arrested him for being in possession of angel dust and wonky hair. And he got arrested, and basically he was ashamed. I mean, he didn't like it. He was up in court, and he said, "Say it loud, I'm ashamed and I'm proud." And the judge pointed out that you couldn't be ashamed and proud. So he said, "Okay, I'm proud and I'm not proud." And the judge said, "Okay, 80 minutes community service," which meant making an album. So he went up onto the roof of the court building and shone an Afro-shaped beacon into the sky, and his house band came in, and they made the funkiest album in the history of the world on Angel Dust. And the funkiest. I mean, it's actually dangerous to listen to, because you will just dissolve in a pool of funk. It's quite the tracks like "Don't Make Me Funky," "You Wouldn't Like Me When I'm Funky." That guy, it's so fucking funky, this album. I mean, look at him. Look at the state of him. And this is before the Angel Dust. This is when he's straight.
Well, it did all end badly when he ran into his old dealer, Huggy Terrifying Bear. Yeah. Who gave him some even stronger angel dust, the Gabriel dust, which then forced him to destroy the album. So, you know, it was one of those rumoured things that you've heard of for years, but you never actually come round to hearing it. Although some of the track listings there you've got.
Yeah, I've got some of the track listing. Get On Up, I Feel Like Being a Warthog. No, that kind of thing. Oh, I Feel Good, Wait, I Feel Amazing, Wait. I Don't Feel Very Well. It's that kind of thing. Some of the tracks. You need to listen to individual tracks.
You do propose a great lost progressive album.
Oh, yes.
Oh, I do.
We're a very populous group with a... Is that...
Well, it's the greatest, lostest, proggiest album in the history of prog. Basically, in about, I think, 73, 74, Steve Hillage gathered together the greatest collection of progressive rock musicians in history. I mean, every member who'd ever, you know, been a member of Genesis and Floyd and Jethro Tull and Gong and King Crimson and everybody. And he puts them into the studio and they ended up making Dodecahedron was the album. A 20-sided album. A dodecahedron, of course, is only a 12-sided album. He's only a 12-sided object. And the bass player of Caravan did try to point that out at the time and said, actually, dodecahedron is 12 sides and an icosahedron is 20 sides, but they were all too stoned and nobody gave a fuck. No. So they made dodecahedron a 20-sided album, one track. It's only one track.
But you couldn't get the sleeve.
Well, that's it.
You had to actually, if you wanted to hear the album, you had to solve a series of riddles, kabbalistic symbols that were on there, arrange them all in the correct order, which would then unlock the first side of the first album. And you'd play that, and then you'd subsequently do this for all the rest of them. It was probably Hypnosis's biggest masterpiece in creating this sleeve. Unfortunately. By the time anybody had actually taken the time to unlock 20 sides of this, punk had appeared and nobody was interested.
Yeah, and there were some physical problems. We'll come on to him in a minute. Basically, there were some issues. There were the famous flute wars that existed during the recording of that album. There was a big flute solo, like a 14-minute flute solo. Peter Gabriel said, "I'm having that." Ian Anderson said, "No, you're not. I'm having that." And they started, you know, they tried to set. They had flute, sort of flute off, and that still wouldn't settle it. And it turned into fisticuffs. And Ian Anderson went, "Your hair looks stupid with that little bit shaved out the middle like a lawnmower, Gabriel." And Gabriel said, "Look, I'm not the guy that stands on one leg. Don't give me that." And Gabriel puts his dukes up, all very public school, and Anderson just nuts in. And it got, you know, I mean, there were a lot of, you know, I think Robert Fripp got a very nasty Chinese burn off Roger Waters at one point. This was the trickiest. This is perhaps the trickiest album in the whole book.
As I said,
because of the legal issues.
But. Yeah, I mean, we did manage to get the Morrissey Panto album. Frankly, Widow Twankly. Which Morrissey said he wanted to base it on his love of something traditionally British, traditionally English, so he chose pantomime. It was pointed out to him that it was actually a bastardization of the Italian Commedia dell'arte by an interviewer. The interviewer was subsequently spanked by a wet slipper by Morrissey, wielded by Morrissey.
He's had a lot of lost albums. I mean, he once famously was just finished an album and then retired to his bed for 3 months because Alan Bennett walked by on the other side of the street without waving.
And
he made a whole album with Tony Visconti that was then abandoned because Tony Visconti bought a bag of pork scratchings, which Morrissey wasn't happy with, and that was abandoned. And this had a very short shelf life, frankly, Widow Twankly, because of an incident when it went live. I mean, they made a great album. Christopher Biggins was brought in as producer.
The Crankies were the Chinese.
John Barrowman, John Inman. It was a great piece of theatre.
Charles Hawtrey, heavily refreshed Charles Hawtrey. Charles Hawtrey was the genie of the lamp.
The genie of the lamp.
That classic track, "The More You Rub Me, The Closer I Get."
Yeah, there's some classic stuff. How Soon Is the Interval? He insisted that during the famous cake-making scene, they only used lentils. And then at the moment when they threw the sweets out to the children, of course, Morrissey wouldn't throw the sweets out because they contained gelatin. And then he blinded a child with a stick of celery. And the whole album was very hastily abandoned, which is a shame because there's some very good stuff on it.
Now, moving from the world of lost albums to
stuff.
This is life imitating.
Well, I'm just intrigued by that. You know, you're talking about dodecahedron or whatever. You know who this is?
That's Centipede, isn't it?
That is Keith Tippett's Centipede in the early 70s. And it's not even the full lineup. Yeah. There are members who couldn't actually make it there.
Yeah.
Extraordinary stuff.
So presumably they're meant to be 50 people, 2 feet each. Is that right?
I suppose they probably were. Yeah. Very early Photoshop here going on. He's not there for the session at all.
No.
But we were looking for examples of kind of things in pop music so ludicrous you simply couldn't make them up.
Yeah.
And
there they are.
This is just a few supergroups.
Andy Taylor's hair. Yeah. So ludicrous you couldn't make it up. Look at that.
We're talking about supergroups, Mark and I, does anybody remember Power Station?
Yeah. But actually, they played Live Aid with Michael Desbarth. By that stage, Robert Palmer, second from the left, had left the group, whose career was so... But it's just like, it was so fatuous, the whole thing. His career was so down the dumper that he joined this group, and then they gave him the success to go off and get a solo album, and he then left and just left them in the lurch and didn't play Live Aid. So the whole thing was just... That's Bernard Edwards, isn't it, on the left?
No, it's John, not Bernard Edwards. No,
Tony Thompson.
That is the great Tony Thompson. The drummer. The late Tony Thompson. But, what a state. What is going on here? Robert, clearly on his way to a wedding. And he drop in briefly. But what I found out today, what I was reminded of today when getting out this picture, was that this group was only formed in response to the fact that the three guys at the front of the group had started their own supergroup called... You may want to avert your eyes at this point.
Arcadia.
Look at that. Now, doesn't that make you, reassess any excesses in the dressing?
Their moms
are
going to be livid to know that they've had their duvets nicked, aren't they?
That is appalling, isn't it? And we're looking for other supergroups. What about this? Anybody know who that is? That is the New Kids on the Block plus the Backstreet Boys.
NKOB2B or something.
Yeah, something like that. Somebody decided that they should, take their very different styles and somehow see if they can mesh them to produce, some exciting new hybrid. And...
Come on.
Gentlemen, remember, this is the worst supergroup I think ever. Can there be a worse one?
Yes, there
is. This is called Freebase.
This is Freebase.
Yeah.
And the whole concept of Freebase was that three, frankly, out of work, but celebrity based guitarists.
Three bass players.
Which is, that's Manny Mounfield of the Stone Roses on the left. Oh, Primal Scream, sorry, at the time. Andy Rourke, I think, of the Smiths. And that's called Hookie of New Order. And they were all out of work and thought, what the world needs is three bass guitars in one band. We just get a drummer and it's going to be brilliant. And then it just went so badly wrong. And I can't remember, they fell out so spectacularly.
Apparently, the guy from the Stone Roses said, you could see Peter Hook's wallet from space.
Yes, that's right.
It was so filled with Ian Curtis's blood money.
That's right, yeah.
They're gonna get on well in the rehearsal room, aren't they?
So relations at that point were really pretty strained, I think.
So you're saying they were not the worst supergroup. You were about...
No, the worst supergroup, I'm sure you've got them up here, is Super Heavy. Super Heavy? There they are.
Remind yourselves, ladies and gentlemen.
Is it Damian Marley, I think? Bob Marley's son on the left. That's Dave Stewart, mentioned earlier. That's Jagger, obviously. That is a guy called R.A. Rahman.
Rahman, yes.
He's the kind of the Mozart of
Indian music.
Of Bombay, of Indian music. And that's Josh Stone. I can remember the PR ringing me up when I was at Word magazine, said, got a fantastic news story. Bernard Doherty. I've been doing a really good job, actually, of selling this. And you're just thinking, this is just like a terrible dream. I just do it. It's actually just like just literally a living page from your book.
You start making shit up funny book.
That's the point.
And then
you
this
can't
stuff comes
make
out.
Up stuff.
No,
more,
no.
It,
we've got
that.
Rock ballads. We've got reggae. We've got Indian music. We've got Joss Stone. It's like names in a hat. Yeah. Right, we've got a super group. We've got Peter Gabriel with Cheryl Cole and Chaz and Dave. Honestly, it's nonsense, isn't it? It's just nonsense.
Has there ever been a super group who gave as much pleasure to the audience as they gave to the members of the group? No, they're like, it's like companies. Companies merge for their own agendas, yeah. not for the public at all. You go and see a supergroup, you're guaranteed to be shortchanged on what you're expecting. Oh, you're, you'd gone for two of them.
You're lining yourself up for massive disappointment.
You are.
I mean, there was... I don't know if you haven't got Asia on there, have you? I mean, the great Yes Buggles supergroup, which again sounds like something from out of our book, but Jeff Downs and Steve Howe.
Yeah.
But this... What? Now this.
I just remember that today because, again, as a magazine editor, I just got I got to be across all of this stuff. This was a concept cooked up by Dave Stewart again in about 2004. And actually, looking back at it, it wasn't very successful. But
it's a man with a lot of time on his hands.
A man with a lot of time on his hands. Dave Stewart invented a group called Platinum Weird. And he then invented an entire backstory about this group, which they put on the internet with fake fan sites. There was a documentary pulling in all his famous friends.
A mockumentary, not sold as a documentary.
Yeah, yeah. With you know, people like Mick Jagger talking about, I remember Platinum Weird, they're amazing. You know, all this kind of stuff, and all the, and members of Fleetwood Mac talking about the lost tapes. It's just like your book. Actually.
The woman there is Erin Grace. Well, she's not really Erin Grace. She's an actress or whatever.
That's
pretending
right.
to be Erin Grace, who was this woman that Dave Stewart invented,
yep.
who was about to be the big thing, and then was so heartbroken and fruck out by the death of Nick Drake. This is a part of the backstory, that she runs off with Elton John's boyfriend,
yep.
runs off to Los Angeles, where Don Henley introduces her to Lindsey Buckingham. They have a relationship which becomes the basis for the album Rumours. This was the whole backstory that was invented and became
so
part
detailed.
Of this.
It's so detailed that at one point, I think, they find an old Platinum Weird tape and put it on, and they notice that she's singing the words before she's heard them. And they think, you must have been in this group. You are the lost singer. I mean, it's so complicated, isn't it? And, yeah, Dave Stewart.
The public doesn't really like that kind of thing,
the,
does
the
it?
Public voted
Johnny
with their feet.
Public.
They ran in the opposite direction.
Because...
Oh, yeah.
Something similar happened with this.
Who's that? How many people know who
does
that is?
Does anybody remember who that is?
Who knows who that is?
Garth Brooks. Garth Brooks reinvented himself as Chris Gaines... You know, came out with a very complicated backstory because he didn't want to be the boring, one-dimensional, hat-wearing cowboy star. And the American record buying public, with one voice, said, what the fuck are you doing?
Well, it was a movie. There was supposed to be a movie. There was a movie that he was in called The Lamb. The movie, I know that the movie is called The Lamb. I don't think it was an adaptation of The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway. But there was an album called The Lamb that featuring this character, Chris Gaines. And so to create buzz for the movie, they got Garth to become this character and release this like pop rock album. And a publicist at the time very famously said, you know, that the American public didn't just not like it, they actually thought he'd lost his mind.
They thought
he'd gone mad. And he features in this.
He is in
Garth Brooks made an album called Complete and Utter Country. please. He accidentally went into the studio one day and on some mix, he was on some kind of medication or something. I think he'd sat on a Grammy and injured himself and he was on antibiotics and he'd drunk and he went to the studio and he made the greatest country music album in the history of country music. He was channeling Hank Williams. He made this amazing album and, of course, his fans were horrified and he was horrified that he'd made this amazing country album and he disowned it immediately. But you know, Complete and Utter Country is out there on bootlegs. No, you can't make it. But who'd have thought that was... Now.
This was a supergroup who were genuinely fantastic, actually.
Yeah, they were.
I think that's the exception.
Because what they shouldn't have done, actually, probably, is to have made a second... Actually, they didn't release a second album. There are two albums. There was Volume 1 and Volume 3.
Volume 3.
Yeah. It's brilliant. There was no Volume 2. But they probably shouldn't have made it. It wasn't quite as good. But it still was a really great record. And they got really involved in it. They all had their names. It was Lefty Wilbury, I think it was Dylan, was it? Otis was, I can't remember who now, Jeff Lynne. And they all had their little names. And they all invented little fictional characters. And actually, it was a fantastic record. It was brilliant.
I think at the time, that a lot of them had done their best stuff for years, yeah. when they actually did the travelling,
probably movies. The old sense of competition.
You think also that what happened here, particularly with George, was they just desperately, sentimentally wanted to be in a group again, didn't they?
They wanted to be in a group and they wanted to be with each other. And it came about for the best reasons, which was they didn't plan it. You know, if you plan it, like all these supergroups you've mentioned, they're all the products of a really bad evening out, aren't they? You know? Whereas these guys, they're just hanging around together and they did a track and, well, that worked. Let's do a few more. And then they had an album.
But it's also that thing about guys, people being in groups, They just get very used to being groups, yeah. Don't they? They're very socialised in groups. They get nervous when they're outside groups.
Yeah, they'd all been... I mean, Jeff Lynn, ELO had broken up quite a few years by that point, hadn't they? So they're all doing stuff on their own. And obviously, I think the Heartbreakers were still together, weren't they?
I think the Heartbreakers had been working with Roy Orbison at the time.
Yeah.
Because I think when they had the idea of the group, they then approached Roy Orbison. And he said yes. And then they went to see a gig. And I know that... I was reading some of the Tom Petty and George Harrison were sitting there all excited saying, isn't he great? He's in our band.
Mm. Well, you would, wouldn't you?
But yeah, I know, but you never you would, think you of people who have been in groups like that getting excited because somebody else
is. He was the big
good.
Star for all of them, Roy Orbison.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Dylan was going, I'm in a band.
It's the only band. Is it the only band Dylan's ever been in? As an equal member?
As an equal member, yeah.
It's well, could well be. Yeah. So we decided that they're the group exception that proves the rule.
Absolutely.
About supergroups. Well, look, we've been talking for nearly 2 hours now, you know. Good God. I've got a home to go to.
Lord. Dave advertised this show would end at 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
He wants to be in bed
and
by then.
And these good people have certainly got homes to go to. But I'm sure we shall be in the bar for individual consultations, book signings, and so forth. Well, would you thank Mark Lewison, Mark Billingham, and Martin Thwaite? Wait, sorry. Wait. Thank you very much for coming.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.